Brent Holland, and welcome one and all to Night Fright. Man, what a day. What a day. The sun was up. It was belting down on the studio all afternoon. Now I'm looking at the studio outside, and the sky is dark green and purple. Looks like we're going to get hit with one heck of a storm, which makes it just perfect for everybody to settle in and relax tonight. Get the coffee going, get the tea going, or a beverage of your choice going. Settle in, relax. Next 2 hours, have we got a guest for you. Most folks that are fans of this show will know of the Betty and Barney Hill story. That's right, folks. Tonight we've got Kathleen Marden on, and she is Betty Hill's niece. Let me just read this. Kathleen Marden is a well-known UFO abduction researcher, author, and lecturer with 24 years experience in the field. She is MUFON's Director of Abduction Research. In 2012, she was recipient of MUFON's UFOologist of the Year Award. She earned a BA degree in social work from the University of New Hampshire in 71 and participated in graduate studies in education while working as a teacher and education service coordinator. She is also a certified hypnotist. Her interest in UFOs dated back to September 20th, 1961, and everybody knows what that date was, when her aunt Betty Hill phoned her nearby home to report that she and Barney had encountered a flying saucer in New Hampshire's White Mountains. A primary witness to the evidence of the UFO encounter in the aftermath, Kathleen has intimate knowledge of Hill's biographical histories, personalities, and previously unpublished historical files pertaining to their sensational story. Folks, don't go anywhere. We're going right there, right away. Kathleen, welcome to the show. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
This is exciting for me. Real living history tonight, folks. For those that are unaware, and there's probably two or three people listening right now, and I like to do this because I like to encompass everybody and not leave anybody out. Can you just give a quick synopsis of what took place in 1961?
Certainly. My aunt and uncle were returning home from a brief vacation to Canada. In Niagara Falls, they're driving through upstate New Hampshire, when my aunt spotted a new light in the sky. It grew larger and larger in the sky. She and my uncle got out of the car. They looked at it a couple of times. And then as they were driving along, intending to stop because it was moving in very, very close, it shifted ahead. It caused my uncle to have to stop the car directly in the center of the road in order not to be directly under it. It was only about 200 feet above the vehicle at that time. It was a large, lighted, hovering disc. It shifted location to an adjacent field. My uncle, with a pair of binoculars, followed it into the field, looked up into the craft, and observe non-human entities staring back down at him. This was all part of his conscious, continuous recall. It's in the early reports. It's not often reported in any show that I do or anything that has been written, but that is what did occur. It's in the records.
So that was a number under hypnosis, and I'm pointing that out right away, folks, because we're going to be looking at that. What the media chooses to cover and what they choose not to cover. And I just want to get that point clear right at the beginning. Thanks, Kathleen.
You're welcome. And then Barney felt as if he were going to be captured. He said he felt like a bug. He'd be captured like a bug in a net. He finally, with great difficulty, pulled the binoculars down away from his eyes, ran to the car, and got inside and started speeding down U.S. Highway Route 3. That's the route that they were on in upstate New Hampshire, not narrow, winding back mountain roads like you might often hear. And the UFO then shifted location directly above the car. Betty and Barney heard a series of buzzing sounds striking the trunk. They were code-like. The car vibrated. and a tingling sensation passed through their bodies. The next thing they knew, they were 35 miles down the hall, the road, and they drove on home. They heard the second series of buzzing sounds that returned them to consciousness, full consciousness. They began speaking. They finally arrived home and realized that it was later than they had anticipated. Later, when they mapped out the route, and they came to the full realization that they were a full 2 hours late, and there was physical evidence that something unusual had occurred to them. I heard about the story that day. Betty called my mother.
Wow, the physical evidence now. What was the physical evidence that they had?
There were several pieces of that. First of all, there were spots on the trunk of Betty's car. They hadn't been there the night before. They were shiny. They were circular. They were all the same size. A physicist neighbor of mine told Betty to, if she had a compass, to hold the compass, to take the compass out to the car and see how the needle would react. She did, and the compass would spin and spin, but when she moved the compass a few inches away or to another part of the car, it would drop down, meaning that this part of the trunk of the car was highly magnetized. Barney used the compass as well. The same thing happened to him. I saw the spots on the trunk of the car with my family. Wow. 2 days after this occurred. So I was a witness to this, too.
And it's once again, you weren't under hypnosis.
No, they were not under hypnosis.
Yeah. Or I'm making a joke here, folks, because yeah, because everybody's, they were all under hypnosis, so they were all.
Oh,
you know,
yes.
Yeah, so I'm just pointing out that you were not under hypnosis when you witnessed this stuff.
No, I was not under hypnosis. I was wide awake and 13 years old. My mother and father and two brothers were with me.
Now, wait a second, 13, I'm looking at your photo right now. Was that like 5 years or 7 years ago?
When I was 13?
Yeah.
What photo?
I'm just teasing you. Folks, Kathleen Martin's with us tonight. We're talking about the Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience, which is her book, Captured, the Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience. Brent Holland Show via Skype, folks. Just key in that address, and I'll get you on right away. You can speak with Kathleen and ask her any questions that you may have. Easy way to get to a place where you can pick up Kathleen's book is www.nightfrightshow.com, www.nightfrightshow.com. Click on any one of her book covers. That'll take you right to a spot online where you can order the book. Now, something I wanted to point out, too, in my research for tonight's show, I found out that Benny and Barney had crossed over, folks. I'm going to put a little Canadiana in this, and there's not much there. Trust me, this is just more trivia than anything else. They crossed over in Niagara Falls, then they drove through Toronto, and probably along the old highway number 2, because the 401 highway, which is the new highway that was put in the later part of the 60s, was just being built at the time. And highway number 2 used to go through all these little small towns and stuff. It looks like they stayed at a motel approximately 112 miles west of Montreal. That would put them approximately in Prescott, Ontario. So I'd like to try and find out if that hotel motel is still around and maybe speak to some people there, and maybe somebody might remember them even staying there. That would be kind of cool. Actually, in itself. Now, what they did after that was they trekked off to Montreal, spent, I think, a night in Montreal, if I'm not mistaken, and then made their way down to New Hampshire. So it was quite a trek. I mean, in those days, it used to take approximately 9 hours, folks, to get between Toronto and Montreal on that old highway number 2. So that makes a big difference. Now, the new highway, the 401 it's called, is the busiest highway in North America. 500,000 vehicles a day go by where I live, and that's called Kingston, Ontario, which is a stone's throw from Prescott. That's enough trivia for that, the Canadiana part. CRTC will be happy. That's the Canadian Regulatory Television Commission. They control the airwaves and stuff. Let's go back to Kathleen. Kathleen, what was the family's perspective when Betty and Barney showed up with this cockamamie story? How did you guys react to this?
We were very interested in what they had to say. We had no reason not to believe them. They were credible people. Mm-hmm. Betty was a social worker for the state of New Hampshire. Barney worked for the post office. They were active in civil rights. They were active in their church. They were normal, everyday, highly credible family members. So we were very curious.
No kidding. How did it affect you? You've got these famous uncle and aunt. You're going to school. You're only 13 years old. How did that affect you in the class?
Well, first of all of this was supposed to remain confidential, so I couldn't discuss it with my classmates. It was only in 1965 that a violation of confidentiality occurred, and the story was published for the first time in October of that year in the Boston Herald Traveler. And that's when the story broke, and so I'll have to talk about how it affected me in the class during my last year in high school.
Sure, please do. Yeah.
So all of a sudden, the students took an interest in my interest in space. And in my senior year, my class legacy was that I was going to be an astronaut.
Right on.
And, so that's what it was. I didn't take a lot of ribbing. If I did take a little ribbing, it was friendly ribbing from close friends, and I knew how to give it back.
Okay, fair enough. Now, were you approached by the media at all to give any type of testimony or any type of comment?
I wasn't in that time frame. The first time I was approached by the media was back in the 1990s.
Wow.
And Betty and I did a few television shows together.
Were you treated respectfully? I guess what I'm trying to do is get across to the folks that may have had a similar experience to yourself, and definitely a similar experience to your aunt, is there's no need to feel ostracized. Many, many people have gone through this experience. And that's what I want to get across. I won't say completely normal, but it has been experienced by other people.
I was treated very respectfully by the media. The only people who, I can't say they're disrespectful to your face, but debunkers will be disrespectful behind your back, that's for sure. And then you end up reading what they have to say.
What are some of the comments that the debunkers have made about this case?
Oh, my goodness, there are so many. First of all, they say that Betty and Barney never observed anything more than a star-like object in the sky, which is absolutely ridiculous because when they arrived home, they sat down and they drew sketches of what they saw, and Barney had a structured craft with beings standing in the window looking down at him. And wrote on it, this is how it looked when it was 200 feet above the car. This is how it looked when it was 100 feet above me. Betty also did a sketch, but she didn't have the beings because she didn't observe them through binoculars the way Barney did. They made a report to Pease Air Force Base. In the report, it states that the UFO was as large as a dinner plate at arm's length at its closest approach. So how can anyone with a conscience or who has done their homework state that it was only a light in the sky? That is complete nonsense. They also like to say that Betty had been a UFO and science fiction enthusiast all of her life, and that she was delusional. All of that is completely false. She had never read a book on UFOs prior to September 21st, 1961. Barney also had no interest in the subject. In fact, he was a skeptic. He didn't even think it was possible.
How, what led to their coming out, if you will, their hypnotic experiences, and what led to them even searching in their own quest for some kind of closure, I suspect, about that lost time that took place?
Well, I have to tell you, Betty wrote a letter to Donald Kehoe. He was the director of the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena. She wrote it on September 26, 1961, only 6 days after she returned home after this event. And she had at that point read her first book. The address was in the book. And she made a report to him. And in that report, she said that they were seeking the services of a qualified psychiatrist who could hypnotize Barney to remove the mental block that he had developed after he had observed these figures dressed in black shiny uniforms through the window of the craft through binoculars. So that is when their search began. 2 months later, they discussed it with Robert Homan and C.D. Jackson, who were two NICAP investigators who came out to interview them after Walter Webb. Walter Webb was the first. Walt was an astronomer at Hayden Planetarium in Boston. Homan and Jackson worked for IBM. One was a senior engineer. The other was a scientific writer. They went over the story at that time, the route, again, and discovered that there was definitely missing time there, and a big segment of missing time as well. So there was also talk about seeing a hypnotist at that point. They contacted Ben Sweat, who was a member of their church, mm-hmm. who lectured at their church. He was an Air Force officer at Pease Air Force Base, and he was an amateur hypnotist. He talked to them and advised them that they should see a professional, that he was only an amateur and did not want to touch that kind of thing due to the emotional trauma that was building up in Barney. He was developing symptoms that we now call post-traumatic stress disorder.
I'm going to stop you there, Kathleen, because we've got two people on the line. We're going to go to Angela first in Lake Tahoe, and then the other caller who just called in will go to you in, after Angela's finished with her first question. Angela, do you have a question for Kathleen?
Yeah, hi, Brent. It's Bill, actually. Oh. Thanks for taking my phone call.
That's okay. Your voice has changed, hi. Angela.
Nice to meet you over the phone, Kathleen.
Oh, nice to meet you as well.
Yes, I had one question. Whatever happened to the car with the physical evidence on it?
Well, Betty ended up selling the car to her daughter. But if you're interested in what happened to the spots, there's a little controversy there. Betty's memory stated that the spots eventually faded away. Betty's daughter said that the spots were still there when she purchased the car and then when she sold it to someone else. She was married to a man in the Air Force, and so they moved around a lot, and the car went with them to the areas that they moved to, and somewhere along the way the car had been sold. Many people have attempted to trace that car, to track it down. No one has ever been able to find it, unfortunately.
That's well, my question. My question was, is how was the compass test done on the car, you know, several times after they originally did it? I mean, when she, you know, did they do it, you know, a year, 2 years afterwards to see if it was still magnetically causing it to go in circles?
No, it was not repeated. Back then, in those days, UFO investigations were fairly new, and abduction investigations had never occurred. No one really knew what to do. Unfortunately, no one even thought to photograph the spots on the trunk of the car. So we only have the eyewitness testimony and Betty's and Barney's statements about that.
I have one last question, Brent. Sure.
Was there any, and I know the story somewhat, but was there any indication that there had been implants implanted under either her skin or his skin?
We're not aware that implants were implanted. No one felt them. No one knew what implants were at the time. However, it causes me to wonder, because Homan and Jackson, after the hypnosis sessions in 1964, asked Betty to participate in an experiment. It was called, they called it a psychophysics experiment, to attempt to vector in a craft. And Betty was to send telepathic messages that were actually written by Homan and Jackson to attempt to vector a craft in to be shown, to show itself or to land in a particular location. And Betty did have some success in doing that. So I'm wondering if that success was related to the insertion of an implant.
That's really good questions, Bill. Thank you for that. Stick around, by the way, Bill. You don't have to hang up. Just stay there.
I certainly will. I got a few more questions down the road.
Thank you, my friend. Folks, we're speaking with Kathleen Martin tonight. She is the niece of Betty and Barney Hill. www.nightfrightshow.com. There you can click on her book covers, and that'll take you right to a spot online, as always, folks. Is that thunder I hear in the background as I look outside? Good night to settle in, and you can buy her books online at www.nightfrightshow.com. I want to continue along with that. I was going to ask you, Kathleen, did you ever sketch your memories down in terms of the what you witnessed in the car? Maybe you even kept a diary, something along those lines?
I didn't keep a diary when I was 13 years old. However, I have recently had hypnosis.
Wow.
And I did sketch what I observed under hypnosis. Now, you know how hypnosis is. I don't know if I was confabulating the pattern of the spots on the car, but they seemed to be sort of in almost a triangular shape to me.
Interesting.
In my memory.
That's really interesting. Because, you know, everybody would think, well, spots, there just could be raindrops or something like that. But I've yet to see a raindrop that would look like that kind of configuration.
I've never seen a raindrop that would cause a compass needle to spin and spin either.
No kidding.
It was highly magnetized.
Wow. When you were a little, when you were only 13 and I guess younger and stuff like that, did you spend a lot of time with your aunt and uncle?
Yes, I did. We had a close family, and my grandparents lived across the street from my childhood home. We lived about 20 miles away from Betty and Barney, so we saw them generally once or twice a week. We always got together on weekends.
Did they ever express, or anybody else in your family ever expressed lost time or something along those lines? Because we know now, we've pretty much established that abductions take place in a family setting. And I was just wondering if you might have any of those, you say you've been hypnotized, any of those experiences, or perhaps they may have mentioned to you that they had those experiences, or perhaps other family members.
Betty and Barney were aware of only one period of missing time. I have some reason to believe that Betty might have had more visitations, and I wrote about these in my book with Stanton Friedman, Captured the Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience.
Yeah, we'll get to Stanton soon,
also,
folks, don't worry.
Also, in my own family, there are members of my family who have experienced what they believe is ET contact, and that's as much as I can say.
Okay.
The family would prefer not to have any of their identities revealed to the public.
Fair enough. Now, without revealing any identities or anything like that, all I want to know is their experience similar to what Betty and Barney went through?
Yes, it is.
Wow. So it's kind of a corroboration right there, isn't it? Or validation.
Yes.
Okay. And yourself, are you willing to talk about any experiences you may have had?
It's, of course, it's transformed over the years. My experiences began when Betty was doing those contact experiments.
Mm-hmm.
She was attempting to vector a craft into my grandparents' farm. And one night, my grandmother woke up. She was awakened by a craft coming in for a landing on the farm. She was terrified. One of our neighbors was a commercial pilot. He also saw this craft coming in for a landing. She finally had courage enough to wake up my grandfather, who slept in a different bedroom, and they looked out the window at this craft. My grandmother had often kidded with Betty that if she was able to vector these beings in, that they should knock on the door and she'd invite them in for coffee. So what happens is my grandmother heard... on the door.
Oh,
and this is, this is why she was so terrified. So we don't know what happened after that, but I can tell you that after that, we started to have paranormal activity in my childhood home, and we had never had that previously.
Let's go
and
there, then.
And that is connected to the UFO abduction, ET contact phenomenon. And we started to see light orbs floating through the air in our homes. They seemed to be intelligently controlled.
Hmm.
There was poltergeist activity taking place. Things would fly off shelves. Doors would open and close on their own in front of people. So
any
at the
speculation
time
to what the orbs were? Do you think they were ETs floating?
I suspect that they were. And as a researcher, many people have reported these light orbs to me, and some have reported that they rapidly expand into ETs.
Really? I haven't heard that. Wow. Jeez.
Now, so, it could be. I have no solid evidence, but this is all speculation.
Now, you're just a young teenager at that point. Did they feel malevolent to you at all when you felt this energy, these poltergeist entities, I don't know what else to call them, did they feel malevolent? Were they threatening at all?
My family was curious about the things that were flying off. They didn't feel they were malevolent. But my brother was nearly hit by one of these orbs that came at him. We were in our late teens at the time. I was off in college when this happened. And he was home on leave from the service. This is during the Vietnam War. And
thank him for his service, please.
Yes. And he's a great guy. He ended up becoming a police detective.
Fantastic.
And recently retired. But one came toward his chest, and he jumped back away from it. So this was a pretty disconcerting an experience for him to have at the time. I heard about it. Back
wow.
then.
And, you know, what did the neighbors think? You know, you've got all this activity going on. Now, I'm recalling I had Peter Aykroyd on, who's Dan Aykroyd's dad. He just lives up the road a little ways. I shouldn't say just up the road, but not far from here. And at their Sydenham home, which is a farm that's located in a kind of an isolated area, they used to have seances in the farmhouse, and this is where Dan got the was introduced to the paranormal, supernatural, if you will, and this is why he wrote Ghostbusters. And, of course, he's big into MUFON, as we all know. What were the neighbors thinking? You know, I mean, they must have witnessed some strange stuff going on at your family farm as well, no?
Yes, they did. And also, one of our neighbors witnessed a UFO come down inland behind their house.
Oh.
So the neighbors were very interested because Betty was doing this experiment of vector craft into my grandparents' farm, and it was, they were apparently coming in all over the neighborhood because the neighbors were observing them too.
She was missing the mark. She was sending them to the neighbors. Maybe the neighbors had better coffee instead of your family.
So anyway, also, neighbors would be visiting my parents' home when some of this activity would occur. And I wrote about this in Captured as well, where on one occasion, my father was a Boy Scout leader, and my mother was active helping with the Boy Scouts as well. And there was a meeting going on at the house, and there were several adults there. And all of a sudden, the door opened, the cat walked in, and then the door closed. So that was a strange event that occurred. There were a number of strange events that others observed at that time.
I wonder how the poor kids at the boys, you know, because I was a Boy Scout too, and we used to sit around the campfire scaring ourselves with ghost stories, of course. And here's a real one for real. Looks like I think we have another caller. Just let me see. Nope. Okay, I thought we had another caller calling in. Do you have something else to add, Bill? Was that you?
Bill, yeah, I had a question.
Sure.
You had you indicated that someone had suggested to set up this scenario where Betty would try and vector in the UFOs. Is that correct?
That is correct. It was Robert Coleman and C.D. Jackson, two of the early investigators.
Now, what happened after you had these two incidences where the craft landed at the grandparents' house and came in behind the neighbor's house and was observed by the next-door neighbor? Was there a paper written? I mean, this certainly was verification, I would think, of what they were trying to show that she could do. What came about as a result of that happening?
These were reported. Some were reported to NICAP, and they're probably in NICAP's files.
Okay. I don't know what NICAP is.
It's the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena.
Oh, okay. All right. That's just because if she was doing this experiment and it proved to work out, I just was interested in what happened as a result of that.
Mm-hmm. Documentation.
It was documented.
Yeah. I've got to ask you this. What led to you getting involved? I mean, you've got a social worker's degree, right?
That is correct. I was a social worker, and then I was an educator and education services coordinator. But back in 1988, I was working very, very hard, had a very successful career. I was remarried a few years before that to a man with three children, so I had my two at home during the week. I had five on weekends. And I was also trying to finish up on my master's degree when I sort of burned out. I came down with what was diagnosed as chronic fatigue that was later, initially as chronic reactivating mononucleosis.
Okay.
And so I had to leave my job and take it easy. And I became bored at home, just trying to decide what to do with myself. I had been accustomed to a lot of intellectual stimulation. I had written about model programs that I had developed and run, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So I decided at that time that maybe it would be interesting to investigate my aunt and uncle's case for myself. I had been reading a lot of information that didn't have the ring of truth. It wasn't what I recalled. It was in the mainstream media. It was on also on television. I wanted to investigate, to interview my aunt, to drive along the close encounter route, to go to the abduction site, to get all of the statements I could from her playing devil's advocate, mm-hmm. and to research all of her files about her case. And she had a very extensive collection of files. In 1996, she gave me a copy of the hypnosis tapes that she and my uncle had with Dr. Benjamin Simon.
Mm-hmm.
I listened to those many times, and then I transcribed them. And I lined Betty's statements up against Barney's statements for comparative analysis. And although I was originally intending to write Betty's biography, it really became a book about her UFO and abduction experiences, and the scientific evaluation of the evidence. And as I said, there was much more than just the spots on the car.
When you did the comparative analysis, what were some of the things that were striking to you?
Well, I have to tell you that initially I was skeptical about Betty's statements under hypnosis to Dr. Benjamin Simon, because she had dreamed these. She'd had one series of dreams, five dreams about this, no more. You might have read that she dreamed them over and over and spoke over and over about them. That's another thing that is not true.
Mm-hmm.
But Dr. Simon had speculated that perhaps this had set the foundation for her to confabulate this experience under hypnosis. So I wanted to find out if, in fact, her statements under hypnosis were identical to her dreams. She had written out a paper, on a detailed paper on her dreams that I could compare it to. Also, I could compare her statements and her dreams to Barney's statements. And what I discovered is that Betty and Barney made the same statements about their UFO experience all along. When they came to the point where they found themselves on a narrow back road, dirt road in New Hampshire, being stopped by a group of non-human entities, Betty and Barney did not repeat the information in Betty's dream. Betty and Barney separately, under hypnosis, and I have to say they were hypnotized separately, and Dr. Simon imposed reinstated amnesia at the end of each session. So they didn't even remember what they had said. This information could not have been contaminated. Barney stated that they were talking, that he said, "I think it's them again. I think it's the ones I saw in the field." That wasn't in Betty's dreams. In fact, in Betty's dreams, she said they sat silently and didn't move. But under hypnosis, each said that Barney said that he thought about going for his gun but decided not to do it because he thought he would be harmed. Betty stated that she was thinking about escaping. She opened the car door and was going to run into the woods. She was intercepted, and then she seemed to have lost consciousness at that point. Barney opened the door, or it was opened for him, and he stepped out, and he put his foot on the ground. Then we hear about Barney's individual experience of being transported to the craft by these ETs along a path through the woods. This was not in Betty's dreams. And what Barney stated was that he felt like he was floating. He felt as if something was supporting him under the shoulders, but that he could feel the toes of his shoes bumping along the surface of the ground, bumping along the rocks. Oh, then he could feel his shoes sliding up a ramp and bumping over something at the top of the ramp before he was taken down a darkened hallway and into an examining room. That wasn't in Betty's statement, yet that was part of Barney's hypnosis. It wasn't in Betty's dream either. This was Barney's individual experience. And Betty's individual experience was closer to her dream, but I found that it was different. Another example of this is when they were released after their experience. In Betty's dream, they were both taken out to the car at the same time. Didn't happen that way under hypnosis. Barney was taken down first. And when he was put into his car, he sat on his gun. None of that was in Betty's dream.
Wow.
Betty was taken down after. She remained behind because she wanted to take that thing that was similar to a book that contained alien symbols as proof that her experience had occurred. She had been told by the leader she could take it. She was told by the little 3-foot-tall person who is sort of the police officer on board or the assistant that she could not have that book, and it was taken away from her. And then she was taken to the craft. So I found many places where there was specific information, the number of ETs who were standing in a particular location, what they were doing, which was not in Betty's dreams, but was in Betty's and Barney's separate statements to Dr. Simon.
Was there a difference in the examinations on Betty and Barney as well? Or were they similar?
The examinations were similar. The ETs seemed to have a very strong interest in their skeletal structure, in their skin, in their nervous system. They did testing on their nervous system. They removed their shoes. They carefully examined their feet, their hands. They moved their limbs to see how their joints operated. They also felt of their spine. Betty thought that they were performing a test on her with a stylus, holding a stylus to her back, and she saw a screen on the wall that seemed to indicate that something was occurring. Barney had his eyes closed, and he did not observe a screen, but he did state that he felt something that felt like it might have been a finger pressing against his vertebrae. So it was the same as what Betty experienced, only with his eyes closed. Of course, Betty was placed on a table after her dress was removed, tearing the zipper in the process. When she arrived home, there was a 2-inch tear in the stitching at the top of her zipper, a 1-inch tear in the thick zipper fabric. Also, her dress was torn from waist to hemline, and the hem was torn on down on one side. That occurred when she was fighting not to go on the craft and gave her escort a swift kick. But but then she was...
Dare I ask forward. Where the swift kick ended up? And would it have made a difference in any... I don't know.
Well, they did take control of her, and she lost consciousness again briefly after that one.
And I certainly don't mean to make light of the experience, but I'm just wondering if, you know, if there was a reaction... if, you know, if somebody gets kicked in the groin, it's going to hurt, that's for sure.
Oh, she did not give him a kick in the groin. Oh. I think it was a side kick.
Ah.
Because it was the stitching on the side of the dress.
I see.
So I think she put her leg out and did the best job she could to just kick him. And it's funny, during her hypnosis session, she was saying, boy, I'd like to kick him.
No doubt she probably wanted to scratch his eyes out. I mean,
most likely.
Because they were frozen, right? I mean, they could not move. Here you are, you're conscious and you can't move. And they're subjecting you to all these kind of very intimate, I would think, procedures. And there's nothing you can do about it. And they're communicating with them verbally, but through telekinesis, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, it seemed to be, it might have been telepathic communication. Dr. Simon asked Betty if their mouths were moving when they communicated with her. Mm-hmm. And she indicated that they were not, but she did at some point see their mouths moving, and there was a sound coming out that was a kind of a mumbling sound as they communicated with one another. Barney also reported hearing that mumbling sound in his separate hypnosis session, and that wasn't in Betty's dreams. And getting back to the rest of the examination, the physical examination, mm-hmm. When Betty was on the table, they pushed her slip up and exposed her navel and produced a long needle. And she said, "What are you going to do with that?" And he said, he made her understand it was some kind of pregnancy test. And she said, "That's not a pregnancy test here, and don't do it." Of course, it wasn't a pregnancy test here at that time. Amniocentesis was developed much later than that, along with abdominal laparoscopy. And he did insert the needle, causing excruciating pain, which, as they do today, her escort, the leader, took away. So, you know, these are good guys, because if you do experience pain, they take it away. And so then she developed a fonder feeling for this one that she had been terrified of initially, because he had taken her pain away, and she knew she wasn't going to be harmed.
So they weren't just robots or anything like that. They seemed to have...
They had personalities.
Yeah, capacity for compassion and...
Absolutely.
Empathy. Okay, that's what I wanted to get across, too. They weren't just designer robots, if you will. Folks, we're speaking with Kathleen Martin tonight. If you're anything like me, you're probably glued to your seat just like I am. I'm looking out the studio window. It's a great night, folks, to settle in. It looks like we're going to get nailed with a big, huge thunderstorm all day long. It's been well into the 80s and probably around 27 degrees Celsius. So there I am. I'm translating between Fahrenheit and Celsius for Canadians and Americans. The clouds are really coming over now, so I think we're going to get hit very soon. I wanted to ask you, Kathleen, also, you know, you're into hypnosis yourself.
Yes.
When Dr. Simon, you were able to listen to his tapes, when he did the therapy, I'm going to call it, the hypnotic therapy on your aunt and uncle, was it done correctly with today's standards, or have things changed in how you conduct these types of therapies?
Things have changed today, but I have to say that Dr. Simon did a fantastic job. He was a psychiatrist, a neuropsychiatrist.
Okay.
And he had built a reputation for himself during World War II. He set up the psychiatric unit at the Mason General Hospital on Long Island in New York, and was very, very successful in treating returning veterans from the war who were suffering with post-traumatic stress disorder. Back in those days, they called it shell shock and conversion hysteria. In fact, there was a movie, Let There Be Light, made about his work. And so he was the perfect person for Barney to go to, because Barney had developed some disabilities as a result of all of the stress around what he recalled and this missing time, but not having the memories of what actually occurred on the craft, which were much nicer than the fear that he felt initially. All he remembered is the fear.
The terror, it must be terrifying for him.
The terror. The same with Betty.
We're going to go to Bill. Bill's got another question for us. Bill?
Yeah, I had a question. They got home, and in the days to come, did your aunt have a examination of her navel to see if there was any cut marks, if any blood had come out, or anything along those lines? That's my first question.
Okay, I did ask my aunt that question. All I can, and I'm not positive that this is exactly what she told me. It's been many years. But I believe she said that her navel was a little sore. I don't think she examined it. I do know that Barney examined his groin because it was itchy, and then not that long afterward, these growths started to appear in a concentric circle on his groin. They were kind of cylindrical and sort of wart-like. They became inflamed when he was undergoing hypnosis with Dr. Benjamin Simon and had to be removed at that point. They didn't grow back. They were not venereal warts. You know, some of the debunkers have written they were, but no, they were not. Betty told me that Barney was sore as well around his shoulder area when he returned home.
And the other question, and I may be incorrect in this, but did Betty draw a map of the solar system as to where this craft came from? I just remember hearing something about that, inquiring about that.
That's okay. Thanks for that question, Bill, because I'm going to cross that one off. That was going to be in the second hour. Thank you for that, my friend.
I'm always thinking ahead, Brent.
There you go.
Okay.
You must be clairvoyant.
Okay, so to answer that question, yes. After Betty's examination, the examiner went into Barney's room on the craft to examine him. She was left alone with the leader, and she said to him, "I know you're not from around here. Where are you from? Where's your home port?" And he produced this three-dimensional model of maybe like a holographic image or maybe like looking through a window. She stated different things as she's tried to remember exactly how that looked. Under hypnosis, Dr. Simon gave her the post-hypnotic suggestion that she should go home and draw that map if she could remember it accurately and if it did not cause her too much distress to do that. That map was published in the first book that was ever written about Betty's and Barney's story, and that was The Interrupted Journey by John G. Fuller. It was published in 1966. Became a New York Times bestseller. Marjorie Fish, who was a brilliant woman from the state of Ohio, saw the star map in the book, The Interrupted Journey, and she was skeptical about the experience. But she reasoned that if this place existed in our galaxy, that perhaps she would find it. Initially, she thought that she would find many matches for Betty's map. In the end, she found only one. She started her work after she read the book, probably 1967, 68. She met with Betty for the first time in person on my birthday in 1969. That was August 4th, 1969. And I remember that because it was my 21st birthday, and I was living with Betty at the time. I was a college student living with Betty. So Marjorie spoke with Betty on the phone. They wrote letters back and forth, and Marjorie went to the local university in Ohio, to the astronomy department. She couldn't check out the astronomical catalog, and there were no photocopying machines in those days, so she had to sit in that department and hand copy the distance data from
the
catalog.
Hang on to that for a second, Kathleen. We're going to come up to the break in about 15 seconds. And I want to keep people on the edge.
Okay.
Folks, Kathleen Martin's our guest tonight. We're talking about Betty and Barney Hill. They are indeed her aunt and uncle. We're talking about alien abductions in the second part of the show. We're going to let Kathleen finish that story. And where do you find out what Betty sketched and what it matches almost to a T. Also, we're going to talk about the movie that was made about their experience. Don't go anywhere, folks. 6 minutes. We'll be right back. Kathleen, stay tuned. 6 minutes. We'll be right back to you. I'm Brent Holland from Night Fright, www.nightfrightshow.com. See you soon. And welcome back, folks. If you're just joining us, I'm Brent Holland. The name of the show is Night Fright, www.nightfrightshow.com. There you can pick up every guest book, or sometimes there's a DVD for sale, or sometimes there's nothing for sale, and it's just contact information. Anyways, there's a wealth of it's a resource that you can listen to all the shows for free. You can find books on there, articles, all kinds of great stuff. There's even photos that some listeners have sent in, and check them out. Check them out. It's a great resource for everybody. We're talking with Kathleen Marden tonight. The book is called Captured, The Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience. Now, just before the break, Kathleen, by the way, is her niece, Betty and Barney's niece. Just before the break, Kathleen was telling us a story. Under hypnosis, Betty was encouraged to sketch out, if you will, a star cluster that she kept seeing over and over and over again, and she did. And we were just at the point before the break where we were going to reveal what star cluster it actually looked like for real, according to some astrologists. And I guess we should go there right now and finish up that story. Kathleen, welcome back, my friend.
Oh, thanks. It's great to be back. Well, Marjorie Fish was an amateur astronomer. She was also a school teacher and a member of Mensa, which means she had a genius IQ. And I think it took a genius in that time frame to do the work that she did. Mm. Because after she went to the university and wrote down all of the distance data, she then had to go back to her house and do all the mathematical computations to figure out where to place every star in its proper location in our local galactic neighborhood 55 light years out. She was building 2-foot by 3-foot models. So they were three-dimensional. She was using monofilament line and beads of different sizes and colors depending upon the characteristics of that particular star that she was placing on that map.
It's incredible work.
Yes, it is simply incredible. In all, she built 26 different three-dimensional models. She still didn't have a match until a new catalog was released in 1971. She got her hands on that catalog. She did the computations. There were stars in that catalog, distance data for stars that she hadn't had before. She now found a perfect match for Betty's star map. But that map had to be vetted. Her work had to be vetted. So she contacted Coral Lorenzen from APRO, the Aerial Phenomena Research Organization. And that was another big investigative organization in that time frame in the United States.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so Coral Lorenzen contacted our friend Stanton Friedman.
Yes.
And this is how I came to know Stanton Friedman, because she asked him to find scientists who were willing to vet Marjorie's work. Stan went to Ohio. He met with Marjorie, and he was favorably impressed by her, by her intelligence, by her scientific approach to all of this, and her methodical approach. He found three scientists who were willing to vet her work. Alan Hynek was one. I think we all know who Alan Hynek is.
Sure, but for those that don't, could you just tell folks who? Stan Friedman, by the way, folks. Fans of the show will know he's been on the show before. www.nightfrightshow. You can find several shows with Stan there. He's a Canadian as well. He lives in New Brunswick, and he's also an American. And he is considered, I would say, I was going to say the father, but he may be the godfather of it all with Roswell. I'm sorry to interrupt you. And Alan Hynek is a very, very famous researcher as well.
He is. He originally worked for Project Blue Book for the Air Force as an astronomical consultant, and actually it was his job to debunk UFOs back then, but he came to realize that they were real, and he formed CUFOS, the Center for UFO Studies, and studied UFO phenomena for the rest of his life. He was also the head of the observatory, Dr. Alan Hynek, an astrophysicist, the head of the observatory at Northwestern University in Chicago.
He's a heavy hitter, folks.
Yes, he is. And then we had David Saunders, and David Saunders was on the Condon Committee. He was had a doctorate in psychology. He was a psychometrist, and he vetted Marjorie's work, too, for the distance data. They found that her work was correct. Then it was vetted at Ohio State University at the Astronomy Department, who did a computer-generated model on the work later, but not in 72, but graduate students did that. The head of the department vetted Marjorie's work at that time, Dr. Walter Mitchell.
So peer-reviewed, without question.
Yes. Yes, it absolutely was. One of her maps actually had 256 stars in their proper three-dimensional location. What Marjorie came up with when she finally was able to identify the stars on this map is that she thought the nickel-sized stars in the foreground on Betty's map that were connected by five lines, meaning that these inhabitants of planets around these stars traveled back and forth many times between each other. They are Zeta 1 and Zeta 2 reticuli. They can be seen from our southern hemisphere, not from the northern hemisphere. At the time, we thought they were 37 light years away from our sun. We now believe they're about 39, a little over 39 light years away from our sun. They're fairly close together, but the scientists who studied them have stated that they are far enough apart to be able to have planets in a stable orbit. So who knows?
Is there any new, I'm just going to throw this out there. Is there any new information if any of those planets could sustain life as we know it?
Well, we don't know that about Zeta Reticuli right now. We need to get out there. It's on the plan, but we have not been able to see that far to evaluate that area in space for planets. So I can't wait until we finally train our telescopes on Zeta Reticuli to look for planets. And of course, that would be the ones at the edge of our solar system.
And I'm reminded of the Bugs Bunny one when the Bugs Bunny commercial when they're looking through the telescope and there's somebody looking back. I think that could be quite possible.
Yes, I think it could be.
Let's talk about the movie, shall we? In 1975, The UFO Incident came out, starring James Earl Jones and Estelle Parson. And it was directed by Richard Kolla. Now, I suspect you've seen the movie many, many, many times.
Yes, and I have.
The next question, I'm sure, is a stock question you get asked every single time. How close to the real story was it?
I thought that it was fairly close. It was, in my opinion, a terrific movie. James Earl Jones did a terrific job of capturing Barney's personality. Estelle Parsons didn't quite have Betty down.
How do you feel the difference was in her portrayal of the character?
Well, I thought that she portrayed a little 60s woman who was overly dependent upon her man, that she portrayed a woman who did not have a good self-esteem, who did not think that she was pretty. Betty did have excellent self-esteem. So that was off.
It sounds like Betty had more chutzpah.
Betty did. She absolutely did. In fact, in her old age, she acquired the nickname Feisty from many people for her outspoken point of view. So,
what were some of the things that really pissed your aunt and uncle off through the years?
Well, I just want to make one more statement about the movie. Sure. My only complaint with the movie was that it again suggested that all of this was revealed through hypnosis, that Betty and Barney didn't remember that seeing the non-humans, that they didn't remember a lot of the events. And that is simply false. It's in the documented information that I show when I lecture on the Betty and Barney Hill case. And so what are some of the things that
really angered them, you know, over the
really
years?
Really angered Betty and Barney.
The middle of the 60s and stuff, there must have been some horrible derogatory statements hurled their way.
Well, I can tell you that some of the individuals involved in this questioned Barney's manhood, questioned whether or not Barney could actually think for himself, questioned his emotional response to all of this. And that really irritated Barney very, very much because, first of all, Barney was a very truthful person. The psychological studies on him said that he was committed to the truth. In addition to that, Barney had a mind of his own. Betty did attempt to dominate him, but she was not successful. He was always saying to her, "Betty, don't be ridiculous." And, she would irritate him and he would not let her have the upper hand. I'll tell you that. Also, yeah. I've seen her tell her off.
I was going to ask you, what are some of your fondest memories, just on a human level, with your aunt and uncle?
Oh, my goodness.
Just one is fine.
In their interactions with one another?
Well, with you as well, sure.
Well, I have to tell you, one of my fondest memories that I've had with them is that they both campaigned for Lyndon Johnson's inauguration, and Barney was a delegate. And I did as well, and the three of us were invited to Lyndon Johnson's inauguration in Washington, D.C.
Wow.
And we went together, and we went over to the Arlington National Cemetery during our time there. We attended the balls and the banquets and the inauguration, but we went to the Arlington National Cemetery in Virginia, and we were visiting John Kennedy's grave. And it occurred to Betty and Barney at that time that there were miscegenation laws still on the books in the state of Virginia, meaning that a black man and a white woman, or vice versa, could not be married in that state. It was against the law. And so they started kidding around and saying, "Oh, my goodness, we might be arrested. And how are we going to do this? Are we going to put Barney in the driver's seat and Betty and I would ride in the back seat and pretend he was our chauffeur? Or would they put me in the middle between them and pretend that I was their child? Or what would they do?" And the way it ended up after many, many giggles was that Barney, of course, was driving the car and I was in the middle being their child and Betty was in the passenger seat.
Driving Miss Betty, folks. There it is, for real. It's fascinating, and I know there's a lot of younger folk right now listening to this that may be unaware of the stigmatization between the races at that time. I mean, there was not a cent, folks, of a black man in the White House in those days. The civil rights movement was well underway. Dr. King was still around, of course, at that point. But man, segregation was in full swing, and you just did not date, never mind marry, somebody of an opposite color, if you will. I've always maintained there's only one race, the human race, and I opted out of the rat race long ago. That's a beautiful story. Thanks for sharing that with us.
Uh-huh. And I have to tell you that Betty and Barney were actively involved in the civil rights movement. Barney was the legal redress for the NAACP. Betty was, I believe it was the secretary for the NAACP. Barney marched on Washington with Martin Luther King.
Did he really?
He was an outspoken advocate. In fact, the governor of the state of New Hampshire had appointed Barney to the U.S. Civil Rights Commission State Advisory Committee for the state to report to Washington.
I'm glad you mentioned this, and the reason why I wanted a human story associated with your aunt and uncle is because I wanted to get it across that these were just normal folks, Joe Average and Mrs. Average. And the fact that, you know, he walked with Dr. King, that's pretty commendable, without question. Looks like we got somebody else that, Bill, do you have a question? You still with us, Bill?
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
This is kind of, you know, fascinating news between working, you know, for or being in the civil rights movement. Brent has had on his show before Abraham Bolden, who was the first black Secret Service agent selected by President Kennedy. Did Barney know of his plight, of what happened to him after he was set up by the Secret Service? Did he ever mention that name to you?
Abraham Bolden?
No, Barney did not mention that name to me at all. The only connection that Barney did have with military intelligence was through James McDonald, not the doctor James McDonald from Arizona, but Jim McDonald, who was stationed at Pease Air Force Base. He was an officer there, and he became Barney's best friend, and Betty and Barney knew that he had been a CIA agent. They didn't realize that he was probably continuing at that time frame, but he was, for a time, Barney's best friend.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
With a question. There's some trivia, folks, some more trivia. We're speaking with Kathleen Martin tonight. We're talking about Betty and Barney Hill and, of course, their abduction experience, which is renowned right around the world. Why do you think it is that out of all the abduction experiences that have taken place, Kathleen, theirs seems to stick out? Is there some sense of authenticity to it all that maybe stands out more about their story than others?
I believe that there definitely is. I mean, there is the scientific investigation of the evidence. They were the first ones taken, and so I think those ETs made a lot of mistakes that they didn't make after that. I should say they were the first in the United States that we know of.
Mm-hmm.
Bud Hopkins had, after that, found someone dating back to 1939, but it wasn't investigated at the time, and we didn't know about that. But so there was the dress evidence that was examined and underwent chemical analysis in five separate laboratories, with anomalous results. They were never able to identify what the pink powder was that grew on Betty's dress.
That's
after
really
she
odd,
placed
isn't
it in her closet.
You think they would have been able to do that? It's very odd. Very odd.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. There's something anomalous about that. I mean, they know that there were oils on the dress, and that they did not come from Betty. And that whatever this was degraded the fiber of the dress. They know that in a seed growth experiment, water that was had the pink powdery substance and part of the dress soaked in it caused the seeds to grow at an extraordinarily fast rate, much higher than on the blue portion of the dress or plain water. The University of Cincinnati Chemistry Department attempted to reproduce the results that pink staining on the dress. They were not successful in doing that, even though they applied a number of different chemicals to the fabric in an attempt to do that and exposed it to UV light as well. So to date, no one has been able to identify what that is.
That's incredible. Is the dress still around? Is it still under lock and guard, so to speak?
Yes, the dress is being stored in an archival collection at the University of New Hampshire. That's Betty's and my alma mater. Mm-hmm. And it's at the Milne Special Collections Library at the Diamond Library at UNH in Durham, New Hampshire.
So if somebody from a university is listening right now, perhaps you may suspect what might be on the dress and you have maybe there's a new modern test for something, perhaps you can just contact that university folks and do some research and do let me know.
Yes, and you would have to contact me.
Oh,
so
I
you can visit my website at kathleen-marden.com, and my email address, my contact information is there, and you can write to me. I review the proposal. If I approve it, then I will contact the university. I'm the trustee of
Understood.
The Hills Estate.
Understood, and that makes perfect sense. And by the way, folks, I will put that contact information on the www.nightfrightshow.com website, and there you will find all her books, her book covers. Just click on a book cover. That'll take you right to a spot where you can pick them up. The one we're talking about primarily tonight is Captured, the Betty and Barney UFO Experience, and that was written with Stan Friedman, who is a frequent flyer on this show. Let's put it that way. He's a great guy. I love Stan.
He is.
Oh, he's just a wonderful guy.
We've written two books together, and we're talking about doing another one.
Hey, Mazel Tov, that'll be great. Please let me know when that comes out, and maybe I can get the two of you on at the same time now that we have those,
be great.
The capabilities. Let's go back now. Now, this is God who have impacted their physical lives as well. Do you think this experience had anything to do with the early departure, if you will?
That's a very good question. It's something that I've thought about many times. I've been asked that question many times. I really do not know, but I suspect that Barney was a driven person. You have to understand that. He was committed to his work with the civil rights movement.
Right.
Once the violation of confidentiality occurred and the book was written, then there was this additional work put upon him in addition to his full-time job. And I think that it might have had a lot to do with his early demise, with his stroke that took him from us at age 46 in 1969.
Mm-hmm. How was Betty after that? It must have just devastated her as well. I mean, to have gone through what she must have gone through to marry him and then go through this experience of being abducted and then losing him at that point, it must have been devastating on her.
It absolutely was. They were a big support to one another. They had a terrific, warm, close relationship, even though they kidded around a lot. That is the time when I moved in with Betty, is shortly after Barney's death, because, unfortunately, the harassment that was taking place in their home stepped up in that time, in that time frame.
Despicable.
Things were happening. Someone or some agency was trying to push Betty over the edge, I think. And so I moved in with Betty at the time. I was a college student. I moved out of my dormitory and in with her.
So you honestly feel that there was a concerted effort to try and discredit your aunt?
Absolutely. I witnessed it with my own eyes.
Can you tell us some of that?
Yes, I can tell you what I didn't witness first, and that is Betty had reported to me and family members, she wasn't going to announce this to the public because everybody would think she'd gone around the bend, but she would return home from her job as a social worker. A couple of times she found that her house had been entered, that all of the coats had been removed from her closet and mounded on the floor, and Barney's scarf was placed over the top of this mound. Another time, her dining room chairs were all taken from her dining room and placed in a circle in her living room. She had prepared her tax information to take to her accountant. She had it in a paper bag. The paper bag simply disappeared from her apartment, and then it was later returned in a very strange way. Yeah. All of her papers were scattered all over her apartment floor.
Oh, man, that's bizarre.
There were terrible things that were going on. Her phone line was tapped. There were witnesses who attested to this. When I was living there, I was in the downstairs apartment. She owned the apartment house. We always kept the doors unlocked, and we always took our meals together.
Okay.
I heard footsteps. I heard the door open to her apartment. I heard footsteps. I thought that Betty had probably returned home for lunch or to take a break or something.
Sure.
So I went upstairs to say hello to her, and there was no one there as far as I knew. I called. She wasn't there. I went back downstairs. And then I heard a crash.
Oh, man.
And I thought, oh, my goodness, what happened? I went running up the stairs as fast as I could. And the closet door was open. The front door to her apartment was open. The front door to her apartment house was open. I ran down the hallway, and I saw a man dressed in a brown suit, a light brown suit, running down the road. I didn't chase him.
I don't blame you.
But I witnessed that with my own eyes.
So definitely there was something going on, something covert, I would suspect. Was Betty ever taken after, did she ever recall being taken after the 1961 incident?
Betty denied that she was ever taken again. However, later on in the 70s, Dr. James Harder hypnotized her. And to let people know who James Harder was, he was the chief investigator for the Aerial Phenomena Research Organization. He was a professor at the University of California, Berkeley, in engineering. And he was very interested in this topic. He was very, very well known. And he went around hypnotizing a lot of experiencers at that time frame. He became friends with Betty, and he would come out to visit her. I saw him at her house several times. He hypnotized her, and under hypnosis, she stated that they came back to check up on her about once a year. She didn't go into any detail, but she did state that under hypnosis, even though consciously, she denied that it could possibly be true.
Wow. So something was going on that she was unaware of, it sounds like.
Yes, it seems that way. But I have to tell you that in Captured, the Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience, I wrote an account and quoted a friend of hers who was at that time a tenant in her upstairs apartment. And he stated that he and Betty had gone out sky watching one night where they had observed a UFO. And on their way home, they had a UFO that they observed fairly closely. And then they felt that the car was going up, almost as if it was going up a hill. And then the next thing they knew, it was coming down again a few miles away from there. And so I wonder if that might have been another contact experience for Betty that she simply did not remember and chose to deny. if it was brought up.
We're going to go to Bill again. Bill, do you have a question, my friend?
I do. With regards to your experience with this gentleman that was running away from the apartment complex, did you ever send in a Freedom of Information Act request to the FBI or other agencies to find out if there had been an investigation going on and getting any type of documentation with regards to that?
I have not done that, but I should do that and should get Stan Friedman to help me.
Bill, are you offering your services? I should tell Kathleen Bill's. Bill, do you want to tell her your background, my friend?
Well, I've been a litigation attorney for, 35 years. And so when Brent knows me very well. And
yeah,
so when I listen to the various guests that he has on, I'm always thinking about what could I prove in a court of law? What is their documented or what is their eyewitness testimony? And so these are the type of questions that I think about. And, I would assume that, your gut feeling was that she was being invaded by, some government agency at the time. The Freedom of Information Act has opened up a lot of documentation for a lot of people across the country with regards to a lot of different issues. The John F. Kennedy assassination, Freedom of Information Act has opened up a lot of documentation. So I would assume that if that was correct, that buried somewhere would be that type of documentation. I'd be more than happy to work with you on something like that.
That would be terrific. I would love to see documentation, if there is any, about that. I have the Air Force Project Blue Book documents, but I don't have anything from the CIA or the FBI or the NSA or any other agency.
What I'll do,
Brent can give you my, contact information and, feel free down the road to give me a contact because, people are surprised at what is out there and what can be recovered these days. And you may have the smoking gun there. You never know. I Brent had asked a question with regards to why this experience has captivated everyone, and I really think that the smoking gun on this is the drawing of the planets, in the solar system. Nobody would know that, and so to me, that's proof positive that this happened. But as I said, there may be some investigation documents out there that would, accelerate things.
Where would you start with that case, Bill?
What do you mean?
Well, how do you go about formulating a request for freedom of information? Would you take her name in specific, Betty Hill's name? And
You take that. You take his name. You send that out to the various agencies, the FBI, the Secret Service, the CIA, and you wait for a return. They have become very responsive in answering responses like this. And my assumption is everything is on computers now, and people that are accessing this information, they punch up the names on the computer that they have, and they see it. And as long as it hasn't been classified as top secret, it's sent out for the most part. So, it's a fairly simple way to go about doing it. And if you get it, you get it. If you don't, you don't. But I think it's something, Kathleen, that you should do and should have done maybe in the past. Because I would think that it would be something that may, bring out some, really important information possibly.
Yeah, so it'd certainly be worth an attempt to do that. I don't know why no one has, or if perhaps they have and they weren't able to acquire anything. I really don't know.
Yes, well, and listen, Stan Friedman is more of an expert on this certainly than I am. But if you have contact with him, you just may want to bring up that question with him. As Brent will tell you, he is a huge stickler on doing your homework and following through and investigating, you know, someone or following the document trail, as you may say. So if you have contact with him, you may just want to bring that subject up.
Well, I have frequent contact with him, and I'll bring it up. We might have discussed it in the past, you know, particularly since he helped to investigate this case. I suspect that he probably has submitted through the Freedom of Information Act a request, but I don't know that for certain.
What I'll do then, Kathleen, is I'll CC Stan when I email both of you to introduce the two of you, and you'll have each other's contacts. I'll CC Stan at the same time, and maybe the three of you can get together and figure out the details. I think it would be a great initial first step. Be interesting to see if anything does come back. You know, my initial gut feeling is it's so top secret it probably won't. But Bill brought up a good point. You know, 20, 30 years ago when they were trying to get the JFK assassination documents released, it was a non-starter. I mean, you just couldn't. And yet now, since the movie JFK, there's a lot more freedom of access to get those documents. So maybe some of it has loosened up in the past 10, 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
It's just speculation. I don't know. I have no inside knowledge of that. Kathleen, how has all of this affected you? I mean, you know, here you are, just a young girl of 13. You witness your frantic aunt and uncle. They've had this incredible experience. And it must be just like a tidal wave that you've ridden the whole time.
It really has. And I have to tell you, I had a pretty mainstream life for many years. But I always had an interest in this because I had a close relationship with my aunt and uncle. But and when I first started investigating this and speaking about it, I have to say I was an apologist ufologist. But I have gotten over a long, long time ago. And I'm speaking out without any hesitancy about that. Right now. I joined the Mutual UFO Network in 1991, became a field investigator so that I could learn how to investigate this case, went on to be MUFON's Director of Field Investigator Training for 10 years. I'm currently MUFON's Director of Abduction Research, and was awarded their Researcher of the Year Award in 2012. So I'm a well-known abduction researcher at this point. I've done with Denise Stoner, my co-author on the Alien Abduction Files, my latest book.
Let's talk about that.
Yes, and we did a year-long research study on commonalities among experiencers. There were 50 experiencers in the 25-person control group who participated, and we were able to identify some commonalities, 23, in fact, among experiencers.
Can you just give us a couple?
Sure. The majority of experiencers feel that they were taken at a young age and they've been taken more than 10 times in their lifetime. Also, 88% of those who participated in our study stated that they had paranormal activity in their homes after their experience. And that is what got me so interested in that paranormal activity in my childhood home after Betty's experiments to Vector and Kraft. Yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty red flag-ish explosive, isn't it?
Yes.
What were the criteria? I suspect it was a common questionnaire. Did you put people under hypnosis yourself as well for this?
No, this was not part of an investigation. This was part of a sociological study that we were doing, social science, based upon my background in social science. I had learned how to do social research. So Denise and I developed a questionnaire.
Can I ask you a question, Kathleen?
Yes.
I've had two people come to me and both seem very legitimate and both seem very sincere and authentic. One of them told me that when he was 8 years old, a UFO came down, the door opened, and out came an alien, and it looked like a fireman. I had somebody else, they had nothing to do with each other, tell me the exact same story. Did you find anything at all that perhaps firemen were something that little kids would default to if they were being abducted?
Oh, I can tell you, other people see giant rabbits. They see giant owls.
I think
they
I saw that movie,
actually. Herd of deer. They see a herd of deer in the road, and they all turn out to be ETs. But either they have some way of cloaking their identity or of affecting the human brain so that we perceive them differently.
Yeah, that's a very good point. That's a very, very good point. Now, what's striking to me is, you know, I always cringe when I think of little kids being taken against their will and what that does to them psychologically. Did your research present anything in terms of treatment for these people that may be traumatized, suffering from PTSD?
My research study only addressed what individuals do about their fear. Most are fearful.
Of course. Yeah.
Because they only remember the frightening part of their experience. That's what you remember consciously.
Of course, that makes
sense. The majority, almost 75%, had difficulty falling asleep at night and remaining asleep. It's a big problem for a lot of experiencers because they're afraid they're going to be taken again. They'll sleep with their lights on. They'll take night jobs and sleep during the daytime. They do all sorts of things to try to control that fear factor. What I have found is that with every individual I have ever hypnotized, under hypnosis, once they get beyond that fear that they recall, they find that they're comfortable inside the craft. They're calm. They're in a familiar environment. They're given suggestions by these ETs that they are loved, that they're cared for, that they might be part of their family. So the ETs are very kind to them once they arrive on the craft.
Interesting. So does that help them then? To overcome that fear and change that whole dynamic around?
It absolutely does help them to overcome that fear.
Very, very interesting. Just out of speculation, because it just popped in my mind, and God knows a lot of things go pop in my mind, is it possible that ETs are us after we've passed on?
After we've passed on?
Yeah.
I've heard that maybe the ETs are us in the future. They're time travelers, but after we've passed on. I think that there are actually extraterrestrials coming from another planet, or other planets, I should say, other solar systems, into our solar system. And I think that they use technology that opens up a window in which these spirit beings, these interdimensionals, can come into our three-dimensional environment as well. But I think that these ETs are using technology. I also think there are interdimensional beings who are visiting. So I don't think it's one or another, all or nothing. I hear all sorts of testimony from individuals. I've spoken with hundreds of individuals. And I think that we've pretty much broken that down into categories.
Kathleen, in your study, I want to come back to the categories, but I wanted to ask you, in your study, was there any surprises? Is there something that stood out in terms of commonalities that was shocking to you? You weren't expecting.
I was not expecting to find that 36% of the people who participated in the study felt they were taken for the first time when they were under 5 years old.
Oh, my God.
I wasn't expecting to find that I believe it was 59% had conscious recall of a close encounter with a UFO, and that that close encounter often involved witnesses observing the craft as well. They were in an external environment. This was not something that happened for the first time when they were in their bedrooms sleeping,
right,
as has been widely reported in the mainstream media.
Oh, sure, yeah. They
that was, that was another one. And
was,
then, of course, the paranormal
ahead.
Activity.
Was
go
there
ahead.
Any sense of smell? Because we always say our memories are triggered by smell, and I'm just wondering if they reported any sense of smell at all.
Yes. Many experiencers say that they've had they've experienced odors on the craft that are sort of either like ammonia,
right,
or a combination of ammonia and flowers. Mm-hmm. Betty thought described it as being similar to marigolds.
Interesting.
And it's different than the smell that the odor that is emitted by these low level demonic type entities.
Yes.
Who have a very foul odor.
That's right. Yeah. Several weeks ago, we had on Christine Corda, who actually underwent a real Roman Catholic exorcism. And she was saying the exact same thing. The smell of a demon is more than foul. It's like rotting flesh and excrement all mixed in together. So it must be pretty awful to experience something like that. Let's go back to your categories now. What were the type of categories, and what was the criteria? Did you just send out a flyer around looking for people that may have had an abductee experience?
Yeah. What we did was I wrote an article for the MUFON Journal,
sure,
soliciting people to participate in the study. I also placed it on my website. Denise placed it on her website. And on several, we placed it on several UFO websites, so that to solicit people to participate in this. I also announced it on every radio show that I did an interview on. So that's how I got this. I also had the questionnaires available on my table when I spoke at conferences. So a number of different avenues of soliciting individuals to participate.
We're going to go back to Bill. Bill's got another question.
Yes, hi, Kathleen. In the study that you did with it was 100 participants, did you say?
I had we had 50 in the experiencer group, 54 in all, but there were four that we could not include in the study because they did not remember enough to include their results. There were 75 in a control group who had not had a UFO abduction experience. So 75 in all that we could count.
And in all of these, did you come across anyone that had the physical evidence that Betty and Barney had, any type of physical evidence that you were able to discern?
That wasn't a question on our study. This was a questionnaire that people could go to my website. They could download the questionnaire and complete it and then return it to me either as a paper copy or via email. So that was not a question. But in my research, in my investigations, have I ever found anyone who has the level of evidence that Betty and Barney have? I would say probably not, but pretty close. And I recently interviewed a man who MUFON has been investigating for the past 8 years, who has an incredible amount of evidence, witnesses, and medical reports. But his identity will never be revealed to the public. He's a scientist.
That's fine. You know, because... yeah, we have to be very prudent in keeping anonymity without question. Bill, did you have another question, my friend?
No, I didn't. I was just, it was a great interview, and I've got, Brent, I've got to go. Kathleen, it was nice talking with you.
Good talking with you.
If you want to contact me with any help with, trying to find out the Freedom of Information Act, that'd be great.
Yes, and I would. Thank you for your offer.
And I'll hook you guys up. Thanks so much, Bill.
Say hi to Angela. I will.
Okay. Folks, we're talking with Kathleen Martin tonight. We only got a few minutes left. www.nightfrightshow. There you will find her book, Captured, The Betty and Barney UFO Experience. Other books she's written as well. The titles will be there. Just click on the book cover. That'll take you, as always, to a spot where you can order the books from the comfort of your own home. Kathleen, what's next for you? I mean, this study must have opened up a lot more doors than it closed, I'm thinking.
Yes, it absolutely did. And my last book did as well. So I'm learning so much more than I ever knew about abduction and abduction experiencers. There's a new organization that has recently formed. It's free, F-R-E-E. A website, contactee.org, is going to open up the middle of June. It's slated for June 15. The top researchers from around the world are coming together to try to solve this problem. And we are going to be posting another questionnaire, actually two questionnaires, on the free website in order to obtain even more information than we already have. And most of the people that I'm working with have doctorates in various fields.
Are we getting closer, not to disclosure, I'm not going to ask that, you know, it's a stereotypical question, but are we getting closer to being able to help folks who have been abducted? Are we getting closer? You know, I'll use the analogy in the 60s, the civil rights. We could never have dreamed of in the 60s, folks, of an African-American in the White House. It wasn't even – it was a remote possibility, not even. People were still being lynched. But now today, in 2014, today, we have an African-American in the White House. Are we moving closer to that type of scenario where people will be more open to come forward? I suspect there's a lot more, and they just quiver in fear.
I find that more people are coming forward. Some of them are using their names. Some of them are coming to me with a guarantee of anonymity by me. And they're telling me their stories. They're giving me their information. People are contacting each other. There are support groups that are forming where experiencers from all over are coming together to share their experiences, to stand up together and say, this is real, this has happened, it is not our imaginations, we are not mentally ill.
Bingo.
This is part of our experience. There is the Experiencers Speak Conference going to take place in Portland, Maine in September. I believe it's September 5th. It's on my website. You can find the information there. It is bringing together experiencers from all over. There are going to be the conference is dedicated to the UFO contact and abduction phenomenon.
Folks, Kathleen Martin's been our guest tonight. I thoroughly enjoyed it, Kathleen. Thanks for coming on the show. Kelly Logue, as always, he's the fellow who puts our website together and everything. He does a phenomenal job week after week after week. Thank you from the bottom of my heart. Thank you, Kathleen. I'm Brent Holland from Night Fright, www.nightfright.com.
Thanks for having me.